Welcome. You're just in time to sit in a session of Shrinkwrapped, the psychology of superheroes, a podcast dedicated to analyzing the psychology of a superhero in a given story arc. Your guides through these subjects are Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, and Sean Kidd. Be advised that your hosts are not trained or licensed clinicians, merely seeking to better understand their favorite characters through a mental health lens. So make yourself comfortable, prepare to receive some unprofessional advice, because your session is about to begin.
Biologically, he's in his late teens, but for half his life, David Charles Haller has been completely withdrawn from reality. His mother is Gabrielle Haller, Israel's ambassador to Great Britain. His father is Charles Xavier. Charles doesn't know. Gabby insisted he never be told. But now, there may be no alternative. With David manifesting immensely strong psi powers, directed by his subconscious, every attempt at reaching the boy, any hope of bringing his powers under control, has failed. His mind, a closed book in a language no one knows. David's condition worsens by the day. Charles is the strongest telepath on the planet. If anyone can help, it is he. This is Case File 003, New Mutants, Volume 1, Numbers 26 through 28, Legion, and this is Shrinkwrapped. Good evening, Agents Kidd and Smith. This is becoming quite the happening for us. How are you on this fine evening to convene once again over a paranormal event in our collective lives and existence?
I'm doing good, Tim. Interesting case we're looking at tonight with a telepath. So very curious to see how this plays out. Makes me a little nervous, to be honest with you, because that's quite the power.
If you could read my mind, you could see that I'm doing great. Excited to talk about this.
Well, I'm glad that makes one of us, because I think I share Sean's sentiments and his nervousness. I always feel a little bit paranoid in dealing with cases of this nature, anything involving telepathy in particular, in the world that we live in, just feels like an inherently greater risk. And I suspect we're not alone in that, because our PsyOps division, I have to tell you, I've never seen them so spooked. This occurred off the coast of Scotland, the Muir Island Research Center. By our point of view, I would say that this is a spooky place, regardless of circumstance, even when things are going as they should there. It's not a place I would want to be on a dark and stormy night. However, on this particular dark and stormy night, there was an explosion of psychic energy is the best and most direct description I have of this in our case files. And we do have, I should stress, pretty extensive firsthand accounts from, again, our PsyOps division, who are able to monitor the situation. But their instruments were recording off the charts. And in fact, it blew out a lot of their very sophisticated technology that they rely on to give them the intel that they need to make these kinds of assessments. And they were stricken by what occurred. And we start with, again, this Muir Island Research Center that is overseen by Dr. Moira McTaggart. And in her care was a young man whose name is David Charles Haller. He is, in fact, catatonic, has been that way for some years now, following a very traumatic event that caused him to withdraw. Now, complicating this situation is the fact that David is apparently one of the most powerful psionic individuals in recorded memory. We're talking telepathy, telekinesis, even pyrokinesis, the whole nine yards. He's manifested all of these abilities on separate occasions and used them in tandem without even being conscious or aware of what he's doing. So we can understand how this would be cause for concern. Again, anytime telepaths come into play, even those who have some agency over their powers, makes me very nervous. I'm never sure if my thoughts are my own. And this is someone who is not in direct control of his power, who's essentially lashing out subconsciously and inflicting his will on the world around him. So we need to determine, how do we respond to this in a responsible and hopefully ethical manner? But we have to be prudent. We do have to be rather practical in our response as well. So there's a fine line we have to walk here. And we also have to look at the role of Charles Xavier. Now, Charles Xavier, as we know, is a mutant, a telepath himself, the foremost mutant telepath on the planet, not publicly recognized as a mutant, however. Come to find out, David is in fact his illegitimate son. So this is the direct offspring of the most powerful telepath on the planet, not in control of his abilities at all. Charles Xavier himself, rather a black box to us. I just, in describing these events, what's jumping out at me immediately is this not a massive conflict of interest for Charles Xavier to be charged with the best course of action here regarding his own son, whose powers are a threat to the world around him?
Well, it's a conflict of interest, and also it either makes me very fearful for the child's abilities or doubtful of Xavier's abilities, given that he is a very powerful psychic who did not even know that this child was a son. Now, that leads me to think, does the child do something to cover his identity, or has the mother done something? How has he not put this together yet?
Yes, it does seem that Gabrielle Hall, or the ambassador, was keeping this information from Xavier. To your question, though, how was she able to do that? Keeping something from a telepath sounds rather counterintuitive to say, does it not?
Yeah, I agree with Jenny. I mean, how does he, one, not, how is this hidden? The other thing that I'm fearful of is, if we know Charles Xavier is the most powerful telepath on the planet, and now we know he has a son who's also a telepath, but one that doesn't control his powers, what does that mean in terms of, you know, hit David's powers and the extent to where he could go not being in control? So that for one is what scares me a little bit as we start this assessment.
Well, there's more good news, because compounding these conflicts of interest, Charles and Gabrielle, of course, former lovers, supposedly news to Xavier over the course of this event, their romance produced this child. Gabrielle herself was in a rather traumatized, unreachable, vegetative state many years ago when the two of them first met in Israel. I understand that Xavier was a relief worker and she was a patient under his care. He coaxed her out of her stupor, brought her back within the land of the living, and they began a relationship. Now, this, of course, is a extraordinary breach of professional ethics, but it is what it is, and they were brief lovers, but through the course of this, they did have this child. And Charles Xavier, in addition to being the world's greatest, most powerful telepath, I assume he can do math. He knows this is...
Obviously
he knows
not.
This is, right. This is his the son of a former lover. That's not in question. That's not a secret. But It almost seems he doesn't want to go there. Like, maybe he simply doesn't know because he doesn't want to know.
Right.
He's keeping this. He's denying this very real possibility. It seems he doesn't even consider it until directly confronted.
And you said he was, you know, helping her, using his abilities to help her out of her state, to help her through some trauma. And that's a level of trust, I think, that is important to recognize in treating somebody using a psychic gift.
Yes, potentially very violating, in fact, right. In hands. And I know that Charles, he seems to have a, from what our psyops, again, have imparted to us, has a degree of guilt over what he did here. It was not a delicate process. It was a rather blunt, almost described as a sledgehammer approach in reaching her and pulling out of her catatonic state as he did. And he feels some measure of guilt in that she had no choice in this, essentially. Now, Gabby, for her part, has maintained publicly and privately in conversations with Xavier that she is quite grateful. I don't know. There again, when it comes to ethics and telepathy, I just always have the question, because when you have this kind of tremendous power, you can make the choice not to exert your will on the world around you. And we hope that this is, in fact, what Charles Xavier has done. Now, at the same time, how would we know? How would we know that our thoughts are our own, that they can be trusted? And even if he isn't consciously doing this, what does that say for his subconscious? We all have unconscious, subconscious desires. When you have the kind of power to make your subconscious desires reality, how can he even stop that, is my question.
You know, and even scarier still, I think that maybe suspected he was the father of the child, and then maybe just waltzed through her mind that, you know, maybe she didn't need to tell him that. And, you know, there's your deniability.
The one thing I will say about Charles Xavier, though, based on what I know about him, is he always seems to be a man of morals. He's always been a good, upstanding guy, always seems to want to do the right thing. So to your point, though, even with the power of telepathy, is he really that? Is subconsciously, is he controlling that? And there's always that in the back of your mind if that's really happening. So the world we see around him and what he portrays, is that really him? Or is that the picture he's put in everyone's head of who he is? So that's always going to be a lingering thought in with the telepath. At least for me, that's something I continuously think about as we look at this.
Precisely. And Jennifer, to your point, there is definitely something to be said for being able to create your own plausible deniability.
Mm-hmm.
Again, whether it's consciously or not, we would like to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I hope that our faith in him is not displaced, but there will always be, at least to me, that degree of mistrust. The path to David's mind is blocked by a psi wall. It protects his consciousness from a world too terrible to bear. With Gabby, I was so sure of myself that I had the answers, knew what was best. I freed her from the prison of her mind, but in the process forced her to relive the horrors of her childhood. Once more, she saw her parents slaughtered, endured the degradation of body and spirit. A part of her has always hated me for that. And now I must do the same for her son. I tell myself I'm helping the boy, but in my heart, I'm no longer sure. So, our journey begins, and the mindscape itself, everything taking place over the course of these very complicated sequences of events within David Haller's mind. And that mind had to be penetrated forcibly by his father, Charles Xavier. He was successful in doing so, but in the process unleashed telepathic abilities that David possessed but were harnessed by another persona that inhabited David's mind, unknown to Xavier and his colleagues. And this, at this point, David is now actually pulling other consciousnesses into his own. Those of Xavier's students, the New Mutants, they become involved in this story. And we see things spiral from here. So we learn now at this point that though David is not consciously in control of his own abilities, his mind has fractured, has splintered, and this is manifesting in, as near as we could make sense of it, a form of dissociative identity disorder. He has alternate personas, one known as Jack Wayne, which he's sort of the name, if it's evoking John Wayne, there may be a very good reason for that. Man of great swagger and control of David's telekinetic powers. He also has a young woman named Cindy, who is controlling his pyrokinetic abilities, and yet another presence, one who is using his telepathy. And these personas are all at war within David's mind, and again, exerting their influence on the outside world as well. So how do we feel about Xavier applying the same techniques that he used so many years earlier and trying to reach David's mother, Gabby? Again, this very blunt sledgehammer type of approach. It seems he should have learned and been able to hone his abilities as more of a scalpel in the time since then. He's become quite skilled, as I understand it, in the use of his talents. Is this an appropriate application of his powers and trying to reach David?
You know, as a telepath, you don't really know what with David, like, what is the right route to go. You know, earlier, you know, what happened was that we do know there was an incident in Moira's lab that it exploded, and you had two people that were in there, I think Tom and Sharon, I think they were both people or patients there with Moira, that, you know, were injured or they were in some kind of state. And I think they're one of the entities that were trapped in David's mind. So if I'm Xavier and I'm the most powerful telepath on the world, I'm probably going to take that approach that, yes, I'm going to enter this young man's mind and find out what's going on in there. Because if you don't, how are you going to find out what's happening with him? So I don't really think there's any other course of action he could have taken.
No, I mean, he definitely needed to get in there, but I think I agree with Tim's point about some delicacy needed here, because there are other consciousness trapped in there with David, but some of them are actual other separate entities, and some of them are some that he has created of himself to protect himself. So you kind of have to get to the root of the trauma, what happened initially to cause this state.
And I agree, but he has to get in there. He has to get himself in there first to find out what's going on in there. So I don't think he really had a choice. But to your point, he does have to handle it delicately, but he has to get in there to see what's happening.
He does seem quite reluctant to do so. And he's being urged by David's mother to take this approach because she knows that it worked so well for her. But again, with Xavier carrying this kind of guilt with him and thinking perhaps that Gabby sees him in this sort of almost in a messianic way. He was literally her savior. And there may be like a degree of hero worship going on here that could be misplaced. But again, we're trying to give Professor Xavier the benefit of the doubt here based on the public good that he has done to date. But there are definitely some questions, and I don't know that it would be his preferred approach if time was not of the essence here, again, in trying to reach his lost colleagues, Tom Corsi, Sharon Friedlander, and to just try to extinguish this situation that is rapidly spinning out of control.
Your shoulders are as hard as steel.
Not for long. That feels marvelous. You've done well with your life.
Ambassador today, maybe foreign minister tomorrow. After that, who knows? Prime Minister of Israel, I like the sound of that.
I too. You never married.
Only met two men worth the commitment. One died, the other always had other commitments.
It was criminal of me to take advantage of you. You are my patient, Gabby. My power gave me access to every corner of your being. There is no greater trust, especially since it was not freely given. I forced myself into your mind, and I abused it.
Nonsense. We both found comfort we desperately needed in each other's arms. However guilty you may feel, Charles, I have no regrets.
A telepath can play God. You've no idea how tempting that is. I can change thoughts, twist memories, utterly destroy a personality, erase it utterly, and recreate it any way I choose. I tell myself I use this ability solely to do good, only to remember that my arch-rival Magneto uses those same words to justify his actions.
When I first understood what you did and could do, I became terrified of you. I asked myself if my thoughts, my feelings were my own or phantoms you had placed there. That's one reason I never wrote after you returned to America. I told myself it was wrong to believe so, that you were an honorable man, that you'd never do such things. But the doubts remained. I couldn't help myself. I don't know that answer, Charles, and I don't care. I'm fighting for the life of my child. I'll face down the devil himself if I have to. He has powers like yours, and he's using them to hurt people. Whoever told me of her mad mutant son, Proteus, and of how the X-Men, and she were forced to slay him. I don't want that fate for David.
If there's a way, Gabby, if there's any hope at all, I'll find it. So as Charles makes his journey through the mind of his son, David, this is where, in fact, he learns David is his son, not by anyone's admission, but through the revelation that Gabby has been pulled into David's mind as well. Her thoughts are like an open book to him, whether he's trying to read and use his telepathic talent to read the thoughts of those around him. This is now fully on display, revealed to him that David is, in fact, his son as much as he is hers. So this adds a degree of complication. I think that if we do continue to give Charles the benefit of the doubt that he did not know going in this was his son, we can kind of absolve him of the conflict of interest, the inherent conflict of interest in that, in treating his son. But now he knows, and he has little choice but to continue his work. And what he learns, in fact, is that the event which caused David's catatonia goes back to a terrorist attack, in fact, in Paris, where David was in a cafe with his godfather, was killed in this attack. And David then lashed out using his powers for the first time in a very protective gesture, in fact, an act of self-defense entirely. But he was far too young to wield this kind of power unchecked. And he, in fact, killed these attackers and in so doing pulled one of them into his mind as this young man, and our intelligence confirms this Palestinian terrorist. His name was, in fact, Jamal Kirami. We have pretty good intel on him to the extent that it does exist. And his dying moments entered David's mind just as Charles Xavier and his students and colleagues have done so on Near Island. And so there's just been this endless war being raged between David and his attacker, who is filled with resentment, this young terrorist who's now a prisoner, essentially, within David's mind. And this is really the source of all of the psychic turmoil that has ensued since then. This is why David is putting up these walls within his own mind, keeping other people out, trying to keep Jamail contained within, fracturing, splintering, creating these other selves that are there to protect him and represent other, perhaps idealized versions of who he wants to be, who he could be. It all comes together at this point. This is quite revelatory, and it proves to be key in helping to resolve this situation. Now, I have to ask, do we think that Charles Xavier, had he been a part of this child's life going into this very traumatic event, could he have done anything to prevent it, to help get him through it sooner? Why did it have to get to this point?
I think that's a big what if, because if Charles had never left, he probably never would have gone through that whole entire experience to begin with. I think it's interesting that the terrorist, or Jamal, I believe his name is within his psyche, and he's created Jack, and he's also created Cindy, and they all have their individual personalities, which are interesting. And I guess the thing to look at now is, it's not a matter of Charles and can you trust Charles or can you trust David? It's a matter of the three personalities and what their take is in terms of how this is going to play out. That's what makes me the most nervous here, is it's not really about Charles and it's not about David. It's about the three personalities and how they're going to make this play out. So that's what worries me the most here.
Worrying, but it's also like completely fascinating to think that this child, in order to protect himself, he had to murder a terrorist, which is awful, I mean, for a child to do. And the trauma of that, drawing in the very person that he has murdered, is a level of torture that I can't imagine. And then having to create personalities in order to deal with this. And then the characteristics of those personalities themselves, one of them being sort of a gunslinger type guy and using telekinetic abilities, the other using the fire abilities and is sort of a like a sassy version, you know, kind of a kick-ass chick version of himself. So it's amazing to me the level of detail that he's come up with in order to even kind of make sense of who he even is as a person. And I can't imagine how scary and frightening and isolating all of that is. And it just levels of complications I can't even imagine how Charles is going to begin to deal with.
It is interesting in the fact that he's created these personalities and characters in what I would call probably his own personal little battle world. So that to me is fascinating. The other part of this is fascinating to me is, long term, how is this going to weigh on Xavier? Because none of this probably would have happened if he had stayed with David's mom. So I think that's an interesting part of this as well.
Well, I feel like the mother bears a lot of the guilt for that. And
I agree.
She is probably definitely feeling a lot of that, second guessing herself whether she maybe should have said something, but maybe she made the right choice.
I agree.
There's only a momentary lapse in Xavier's concentration as he's staggered by the revelation and all of its myriad implications, but it proves fatal. His protective energy bubble pops, and he barely manages to catch hold of Danielle Moonstar before she and the others are swept into the abyss. He strains with all his might to pull them to safety against a wind that pits the most terrible of hurricanes to shame, to no avail. He lets the maelstrom take him, following its funnel down into chaos, trying not to hear the mocking, malevolent laughter that shakes the astral plane in his wake. Unnoticed in the confusion, the sleeper stirs, watching with gleeful, hating eyes that revel in the youngster's anguish. He smiles, and then sleeps once more. Now, folks, I am struck by the personality known as Jack Wayne's role in all of this. He, I think we can all agree, would be the dominant persona within young David. He's sort of calling the shots. And I think it's very telling that he manifests in this image, this character, who Charles Xavier himself is very drawn to. And I think in a way, finds somewhat aspirational himself. So this is someone who both David and his father equally would want to admire and see themselves in and almost implicitly trust. And I think it's just very telling that that's where David's subconscious mind would go. Just sort of this, making this effort to impress his father and not knowing even necessarily that Xavier is his father, but piecing this together through this, you know, very fragmented perception that he has. I think there's something to that, because what's important and recognizing this is that Xavier seems to lose his objectivity in interacting with Jack Wayne, right? He sees him as someone to be admired, he wants Jack to like him, I feel like, in the way that many other people admire and look up to Charles Xavier himself. And it's actually Xavier's students who are able to kind of see through this and detect this duplicitous nature of one Jack Wayne. I'd like to spend some time with this, Agent Kidd.
Jack is a very powerful personality. He's very persuasive. He's very charming. He's got an air of adventure. He's full of confidence. And if you look at him as an individual, he's almost like the cool kid in school that you want to be friends with. And for David, that's probably the personality he created as someone that he would like to be. There's a little bit of air of danger to him, but he's also very, very cool and just carries himself very, very well with an air of confidence that David probably never had. So I think that's dangerous. At the same time, I think it's good that Charles's students saw through that. However, it's interesting to me that Charles was also kind of enamored with Jack's personality, which kind of goes with probably why David was as well. Their father, yeah. Their son, and they might both have the same thought process around this entity, that this is someone they wanted to be. So I think he's a very interesting aspect of David's personality.
Yeah, probably a lot of that male father figure energy stuff too, mm-hmm. happening there too. Like, you know, the image of a perfect father, you know, somebody he would want his own dad to be.
Whatever affects my psychic form affects my physical body. Pain or injury here has an equivalent analog there, but the reverse also holds true. I can muster only a fraction of my normal strength, and that requires extraordinary effort. It's a vicious, self-destructive cycle. The more effort I make, the weaker I become. I'm forced to try harder, which makes me weaker still. Only victory or defeat will break the pattern. One will save my son, but both might cost my life. All right, I'd like to comment as well on not just the emotional and psychic state of Charles Xavier in the course of these events, but his physical health as well. I understand that he was the victim of a rather brutal beating, perhaps even motivated as a hate crime, shortly before these events occurred. This back in Westchester, on the grounds of his school, in the course of his duties as headmaster of the school for gifted youngsters, of course, was severely injured, is just making a recovery from that, and he is still not quite himself. Now, he this has taken a toll on him physically, and the exhaustion leaves him unable to access the full extent of his telepathic powers. Exerting his powers, in fact, puts so much strain on his body that it leaves him in an even weaker state. So he is overtaxing himself. This, to me, I feel like represents another risk. He is, you know, going on record as describing the temptation of his own great powers, just keeping his own desires in check, because it would be so easy to bend others to his will, to just lash out at any opportunity, having the power to do so. And when you are physically injured, when your body is not operating at 100%, that's just an additional layer of stress. And this is someone who copes with stress on a daily basis as it is. And I just, I question once again, if in fact, this shouldn't be dealt with by someone else. I know that Charles Xavier is not one to sit it out, but knowing not just the risk to himself, but to those around him that are posed by him acting when he is not at his full mental or physical health, seems a great deal riskier than it should be. Should we comment on his physical shortcomings here?
I mean, I'll say one thing. I mean, it does seem risky, yes, but at the same time, who else is there to help this situation? I think the other best well-known telepath that we know of was Jean Grey, and at this point, she's dead. So who else would be equipped to take this challenge on, even if Xavier is not in the greatest of health? I think he would be the foremost authority to go after it.
Yeah, I got to think that his physical condition is probably, you know, it's a concern, but really the least of his concerns, where especially once he finds out about being David's father. I mean, I think that in some ways it might have been very shrewd of the mother to do it in this way, because there's no out. I mean, he has to continue with this in order to save his son. So that's his main goal at this point.
And he's doing his best to push through it.
Right.
His students have already been jeopardized as well. And in fact, it is their intervention that proves key in resolving this. Again, seeing through that duplicitous nature of Jack Wayne and getting to the bottom of what was really going on, which was largely Jack manipulating events and Jamail having a change, coming around to the fact that it wasn't so much David's fault and David's intentional actions that brought him to this state, and doing what he can to try and repair David's fractured mind, quite literally from the inside, was an agent for good, as it would seem. So ultimately,
what an unexpected ally Charles found in that terrorist who we assumed to be the bad guy in all of this, and how he was holding David hostage in his own mind. But it turns out that he recognized David for what he was and just set out to help him, which is amazing to me.
Which is another question I had, and that's a great point, Jenny. The other question I have is, what's the responsibility of Xavier for bringing children and other students into this game? And even though long played out, it actually helped the situation because they were there to assist and help, but it seems to be a little bit irresponsible of Charles to bring other kids into this situation, especially to help with his own child when they're kids themselves. I find that interesting.
Well, you know, I think that Charles knows that in the end, these kids, it's training, right? He's training them for the superhero life. And this is the sort of things that they're going to be into. So I just feel like it's on the job training for young kids who are empowered. So it gives
you a message. I agree with you. It's just the one situation that sticks out for me is Ron Sinclair and her, this being her home, and her childhood was very, very messed up by being raised by this reverend who's still on the island. So I just think psychologically that would be a deterrent right there for her to be in this situation. So those are the things I also think about on the side, but ultimately it works out. So
right.
Yes, I will say that this is somewhat consistent with Charles Xavier's history of, well, creating child soldiers effectively. Though it tends not to be his intent, as near as we can tell and hope. It's almost a joke at this point that these students, this is the second, arguably third generation of students, and they are meant to be students and not soldiers, not superheroes. But time and again, we see them drawn into these conflicts. I do go back to wondering, speculating, and it is pure speculation on my part, if Xavier's judgment is compromised here again by the stress he's under, the injuries he's endured. Maybe he's not making the best decisions that he would otherwise be if he was in a better state all around. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Sean, about the role of the students in this as well. You might say the students become the teachers in mm-hmm. the end, appropriately enough. Before him lies madness, a child's crazy quilt synthesis of Paris and Beirut. One set of images from David's memories, the other, Xavier presumes, from the young Arab's supernal beauty scarred by total war. Everything is larger than life, as it would be for a child, David's influence extending to the weapons and machines that ravage the mindscape, making them living monstrous, demonic avatars. Everywhere there are screams of grief and agony as the people see their loved ones slaughtered or slain themselves. The air is thick with smoke and a stomach-churning charnel stench Xavier hasn't smelled since he fought in his own war when he was a young man. How long has David been like this, he wonders, unaware of tears streaming down his own cheeks. Since he was attacked? But that was nearly half his lifetime ago. How can any consciousness, any soul endure such torment and remain sane? And if insane, how then can even I heal him? His eyes turn to a huge, darkly brooding dome that dominates the madcap metropolis, and he senses instinctively that it holds the answers he seeks. The trick, of course, will be surviving long enough to reach it. Ultimately, David is reached through this nightmare hellscape of his own mind that he has constructed. And we, I think, get a sense for the first time the full degree of his arrested development. This is essentially a 10-year-old in a 20-year-old's body now. And the landscape of his own mind very much reflected that. One just subjected to extreme trauma, relived over and over and over, a kind of post-traumatic stress that just replayed itself and was visited on others through no fault of his own. This is a child who really has no culpability in his actions. We learn as well that the disparate personalities in Jack Wayne and Cindy and Jamail were not fully reintegrated, and they do remain somewhat independent. And it remains to be seen how that will be managed, how they perhaps they'll work out some sort of timesharing arrangement. I don't know what else to call it. But at the end of the day, this is where we are left. David is now cognizant, conscious with the world once again, and has a few passengers now along with him. So do we feel like this concluded in a good place? Do we consider this a good outcome? Is this a win?
Their safety and his slight recovery is a win, but there are definitely concerns about this young man. His intense strength and power, his ability to control people, which I don't think can be outstated, that he probably has some new tricks that we've never seen before, and we do not know the extent of his powers. So I think he warrants some watching, for sure.
I think I would use the battle was won, but the war is not over analogy. If the personalities are still in there, and yes, he's in a much different spot than he was when this whole thing started, but it's kind of like Jenny said, it's the unknown. How's it going to play out? What's the long-term ramifications? What's the tricks under his sleeve? So we're kind of in a status of unknown of what happens from here, even though we're in a better place than we were. It's still long-term, a little scary and thought to think about. And we're really going to have to monitor this situation and really watch this young man.
And the good news is that Charles, his gift, I think, instead of his mutant ability, is leading people. And he has, you know, as this child's father, he has a unique ability and a unique reason to work with him and try to rehab him as much as possible and mold and shape David's powers in a way that can be helpful.
And he also has the power of just being his father now too, which could go a long way in helping here as well.
Yes.
The responsibility, in fact, for being his father, there can be no excuses at this point.
Right.
Going forward. And certainly David's evolution is not complete. I will say that I remain as paranoid as I was, if not more so, going in when it comes to my perception and response to telepaths in the world around us. You know, there are ways of dealing with people who have this kind of power, and there's technology that does exist that can protect us, and I do question and wonder why that isn't in greater use. Certainly, you look at Magneto, the arch rival to Professor Xavier. His helmet incorporates circuitry, in fact, that prevents Xavier from reaching his mind. And I just think to myself, why hasn't Stark reverse engineered this? Why isn't every home and office building and vehicle, like, somehow, why doesn't that incorporate this technology? Why don't we have some kind of security and peace of mind that we're safe from these kinds of intrusions? Some would go a step further and take the more militant attitude of, why don't we take these people out when they don't see it coming and just eliminate threat pragmatically? We could do that, but I think that does also eliminate the capacity that they have to do good. Ultimately, I think that Xavier did do a good deed here. I think he was helped along, certainly by his students as well. I think that they were key to breaking that cycle of abuse that got us to this point in the first place and saw things that he didn't. But that is a credit to his influence and his tutelage. So at the end of the day, I think it's maybe not the fairy tale ending that you'd like to see, but all told, we're in a better place than coming out of it than we were going in.
It's a very to be continued situation, definitely.
David is much better, Gabby, but he isn't cured.
And you doubt he ever will be, is that it?
I don't know. You saw his mindscape. Jamail didn't cause that. His memories merely provided elements of the stage settings and props. David wrote the script. Deep down inside, he's still confused and hurt and angry. He's a boy growing up in a man's body, twice his age. He knew he had a father, yet that father seemingly abandoned him and his mother. And later, when he needed his mother the most to save his life, she wasn't there. Primal losses and failures, prompting equally primal responses. Cindy described it best. Remember, she's but a reflection of the boy himself. They say they love you, but when it's a choice between your lives or theirs, you get the chop every time.
My fault, then. My failures. My mistakes.
Mine, too. I had a hand in his creation. But guilt does none of us any good. The past is done, Gabby. We must look to the future and try to make it as bright as can be.
Can you help him?
I can try.
This is Unwrapped. This is where we wanted to do like a quick little review of the story that we've sort of in our own way dramatically read. So right now we're talking The New Mutants numbers 26 through 28. Is that correct? From 1985?
That's right. And we're talking them. Hi, this is Tim, Jenny, and Sean as ourselves, not as exaggerated versions of ourselves or characters. Yeah, we're doing this thing called Unwrapped, which we just named. And
it's a show within a show.
It's a show within a show. So are we going to do this every time, you guys? Or are we just going to, did we just want to see
I
how
think
it goes?
That if we want to talk about the book, then I feel like we can, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of these needs a little bit of unwrapping at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are very serious and we play a serious take on it. I think it's good to kind of unwind after it and kind of look at it from each of our perspectives. I think it's a good idea.
Also, I just have like thoughts as a comic book fan about this, like particularly like the art I thought was really good. Like there's a lot that you have to do, I think, if you're gonna draw a battle scene that takes place within someone's mind. And the images that they came up with for this, I thought were amazing. Like the dome that David creates over like his inner core self, like a physical representation of like a barrier. They did that several times throughout the comic with Charles trying to break through to David. So they used walls a lot, and there was a lot of like, you know, just a lot of like breaking type imagery in the art, which I really, really did like.
Astral figure planes.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of imagery in this, a lot of it.
Yeah, this is Bill Sienkiewicz, easy for me to say, and easier to spell, really coming into his own and becoming the Bill Sienkiewicz that everyone knows him as. He, cut his teeth doing, like Moon Knight, I think. Helped me out, Sean, and it was sort of like a Neil Adams-y style, like pretty, I mean, really talented, really good stuff. I love his early work, but I mean, he's a mile apart here, just would not be recognized as the same artist.
I would say he brought New Mutants in kind of to their own universe. You know, they were spun off from the X-Men, but I think his artistry really bridged him out in terms of how people viewed him. The art, it's just, the art in this is just amazing and pops at you. And whenever I think about him, I immediately go back to his run on New Mutants, because I think about all the stories and his art matching up with it. So every time you hear his name, this is what I think of, actually.
And I love the visual so much too, just the way that it's like a Salvador Dali painting, like the nightmare surreal imagery. Like the one that sticks out to me is when the students are basically climbing the Eiffel Tower, which is a thing that can happen in a story like this,
right,
and being pursued by these monsters like made of barbed wire. And I mean, it's just, it is so stunning. And to think that this was, a mainstream comic book in the 80s. Like, this was not some niche underground,
cult.
This was a spinoff of, like, the highest selling top comic in the industry, and a real juggernaut in its own right. You know, everybody read X-Men, everybody read New Mutants. So it's just unfathomable that they would take such an unconventional artistic approach to something that is, like, supposedly that marketable and meant to be that accessible and mainstream.
And he also kicked off his, and sorry, Jenny, he also kicked off his run with another really impactful, you know, quintessential New Mutant story that actually became the basis for the movies and Demon Bear. And he drew that whole saga as well. That was his first work on this. Yep. So yeah, amazing.
The mix of styles, like, and colors too, like the, so there's, like, very, like, sort of pastel-y and watercolory, sort of undefined edges. Like, it looks like a kid is dreaming to me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
it's exactly what's happening. It completely sells that effect.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Like, dude, it's really good. And with as much crazy dialogue as this is, like, they actually make the panels look okay with all of the crazy word bubbles all over the place.
Well, and I think Claremont's writing with this art makes it even better. It's a great mix of two different styles, which really intermingles well together, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Claremont, that was something he really excelled at, was tailoring his scripts, as sort of heavy-handed as they can be, but tailoring his scripts, his stories, his plots to his artist. Like, just imagine... This may not mean anything to a lot of people listening, but, like, just imagine if, like, Sal Buscema drew this story. Like, I mean, he's great. I mean, I love, I think he's terrific for what he does, but there's just no comparison. And there's no way Claremont would have written this story to somebody like a Sal Buscema. Like, he clearly saw what he had in Bill Sienkiewicz and said, go nuts. Because I sure am. And Jenny, I'm glad you brought up the colors as well. You know, I think colorists don't get enough credit. And I sort of, you know, going into this, I think I'd kind of always been under the impression that Sienkiewicz did everything, like pencils, inks, colors, all of it. But, I mean, it does say that Glynis Wayne is the colorist here. So... I mean, that's someone who, she's always been a very traditional kind of comics colorist. And here she just is like, that's not going to work for this kind of story. I've got to stretch myself. And, you know, I probably relish the opportunity to do so, because it is not that Marvel house coloring style of the 80s.
Something interesting just on a random panel was when they were doing, like, the terrorist backstory, and the moment where he dies, his whole body is colored red on a white background, with no panels or anything, just free form. Like, oh, it's striking.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and just we don't have traditional panel layouts either. Like, there's not those typical, you know, borders and gutters, and just it's not the anatomy of a typical comic book by any means. There are things going on that are, like, you'll have an image. I don't even know how to describe it. It's one of those, you have to see it yourself, but you'll have an image.
Batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Like, batshit art. It's
an
wonderful
image doing one thing in the foreground, but also interacting with characters in the background and serving a purpose. It's almost like, it seems impossible. You know, you have comic book artists who are good storytellers, just good sequential storytellers, and others who are just good pinup artists. There's no story. It's just image after image of, you know, it's here's a cool
page.
Yeah, static image. And somehow this manages to accomplish both. And I don't understand. It kind of breaks my brain to try to conceive of that.
So what about the story? So the art's great. What'd you guys think about the story itself?
I really liked it. Like, you know, aside from Charles being an absolute dumbass, I was like, what? Even I know he's your son, and I just started reading this.
Yeah, the signs were there right out of the gate, right?
Yes.
So that's the thing that's funny about the story. Like, the story's great, the character's great, the development's great, the personalities that he, like, Claremont's a genius in this stuff. And the writing, and he created Legion, who everybody knows has a lot of long-term story play out for himself. But the dumbest thing in this whole entire story that we've all talked about amongst ourselves is the single greatest telepath on the world does not know that he has a son long-term. And even when he meets his son and meets the lady he had relations with, still doesn't know it's his son. Ludicrous.
The more I think about it, the more I'm just like, That's not possible.
Well, it's weird because it almost, in a way, it's so easy to take apart and criticize. But even if you could really square that and be like, okay, yeah, I can see how he might be in such a degree of denial that he doesn't grasp this until it's truly staring him dead in the face. I'm sort of like, how much does it really add to the story to make Legion his kid? Like, this is a great story in its own right. And if you just took that out and said, this is Professor Xavier trying to help this mutant kid who's just completely out of control and threatening to kill everybody like that. I mean, that's still a very Professor X thing to do, right?
That's true. That's a fair point, too.
But how much play do they see in Legion as a character being Xavier's son? I mean, a lot of shit happened years and years and years after this story. So.
Yeah, well, in this, you say that, and I think it, too, but I'm like, you would think Legion would have been a bigger deal as a character after this story. Like, you introduce... now, like, the Mr. X-Man, basically, has a kid... Like, that seems like it should be a much bigger deal than it ends up being. I mean, yeah, they do get some mileage out of him later, but it's many, many years later. Like, it seems...
after this story, he kind of stalls out for a while, and you don't see him for a while.
He does, yeah. I mean, they do the stuff with Mystique and Destiny, which, I mean, even that, like, there's no reason it had to be Legion who was involved in any of that stuff.
Wasn't that, like, 6 years after this?
Yeah, no, and even like that
6 years
was...
later. Yeah.
It was the late 80s when all that happened. Yep. Might have even been...
91, I think.
Wow. So, yeah. I mean, yay, going to Age of Apocalypse, and I do think that it makes all the sense in the world to have him be kind of the catalyst for that. I mean, there is some thematic relevance there. Say what you will about Age of Apocalypse as a story. But then he vanishes for years, like, I would say over 10 years, he's gone after close to 15 years, probably. He's gone after Age of Apocalypse. And then they did the stuff with the solo series, of course, the TV show, which borrowed from that. But he's not like the big deal character you would think of him as after this kind of introduction and this kind of connection to such another important establishment.
It's not like Cable being the child of Cyclops. Cable's a much bigger deal, and Legion should be just as a big a deal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The other thing that we didn't talk about during the initial pod is I like how they intertwine different storylines separate that we didn't talk about. You had a storyline around long term what they're setting up for Magneto. You have a storyline they're setting up with the Hellfire Club. Mm-hmm. And they're setting up all these different little stories that are going to play out over multiple issues coming up. So I like how they threw like little panels of that in between this as well.
Yeah, all those great Claremontian subplots that they don't really have any connection to the A plot here, and hence we don't talk about them at all in the show proper. But that's just what he did. He would do it in X-Men. He would do it in New Mutants, and. I mean, really, you could take some of these subplots, the Magneto stuff, it would be right at home in his X-Men stories. It's just, he already had enough subplots.
It's interesting, the subplot is Magneto having sex, and Charles's story is about how sexy it had, so...
Yes!
And then Empath trying to get dirty with Emma Frost, I really enjoyed, too. But that's
Yeah, that was funny.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, she puts him in his place. Yeah.
Yeah, she does.
So, but I enjoy that stuff, and it kind of keeps you wanting to keep reading. But back then, it kept me wanting to read the series, even though it wasn't a part of the story I was reading. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're kind of actually talking me into maybe there is more thematic relevance, if not a plot connection. I mean, you've got sort of this, as you said, this burgeoning romance with Magneto and Lee Forrester, who is a human, much as Gabrielle Haller was human. And having this very sort of humanizing effect on these, like, powerful, like, alpha men, in a way.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I could see some relevance there. Some resonance, I guess I should say. Even the empath stuff. I mean, talk about my whole spiel about ethics and telepathy.
He's a bastard.
Yeah, he's one of the worst.
Yeah.
Yep. Talk about where he can't read your thoughts, can't control your thoughts per se, but can control your emotions, which is really just as powerful.
Even worse, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, can tell you exactly how to feel about him or how to feel about anything. That's an incredible power.
Yeah, it is. Donald Trump has that same power.
Oh, God.
Jesus Christ.
All right, so anything you want to say? I feel like on these little things, we'll just, like, you know, say whatever we want to say about it, and then maybe give, like, a little rating or say, like, if you think we should, you know, is it worth reading or whatever.
For me, this is one of my favorite stories growing up. When this came out, I was 12, so aging myself as I always do on podcasts. But it's one of my favorite comic book stories. The New Mutants in general during this time period was one of my favorite. It was one of the ones I had delivered to my house, one of the chosen four. So absolutely go read this. It's a nice little three book read and sets up a great character and really great writing, really great storytelling. Just ignore the fact that Charles is a telepath and doesn't know he has a son. That's kind of it's a big plot point, but at the same time, if you ignore it, it's a really great story and great read. I absolutely love it. And if I were to go on a rating of 10, I'd probably go 8 out of 10 on it.
Oh, interesting. What about you, Tim?
Yeah, I really do enjoy the story a lot. I say what you will about Chris Claremont and the way that he writes and his purple prose and how wordy he is, and I just eat it up. I really love that shit, and I don't tolerate it. I really don't tolerate it from anyone, but something about Claremont is...
Because he's so distinct in how he writes it that makes it etched in your mind. You're right. There's just something about it.
Yeah, it is so vivid. And I would say that, you know, this isn't maybe the most accessible story right out of the gate for someone who hasn't maybe read a ton of comics or isn't super well-versed in X-Men, just because you do have all these little side plots going on. And I mean, some people might be really just intimidated or put off by the art, which, I mean, we enjoy, but I can see some people looking at that and going, I don't think
I will tell you, 12-year-old me, when I pulled it out of the mailbox, said, what the fuck is this?
I was going to say, you're a 12-year-old.
To be perfectly honest, that's what happened. So.
But you stuck with it, right?
I mean, did, because I liked the story.
Yeah. I think it is a good companion with Claremont's Uncanny X-Men. Well, then just X-Men, I guess, because there's only the one X-Men series. So yeah, a lot of times it felt like you sort of had to be reading both books. But at the end of the day, I was 1 year old. Okay. When this came out, going on 2 years old. So, not old enough to read or frankly even have, object permanence, to recognize that, comics are a thing that exists. But I love, absolutely love 80s comics, 80s Marvel comics particularly, and I am an X-Men dude through and through, and this is, I really do enjoy this story. I mean, we didn't really even get into some of the heavy themes that Claremont seems just totally comfortable really delving into, like all the I think we scratched the surface of just that cycle of abuse stuff with Xavier and his treatment of Gabby, who was a survivor of trauma herself. Mm-hmm. And
or the preacher and Wolfsbane, which is a little snippet in this as well. So.
Reverend Craig and Wolfsbane, which, is just a scene, really, to remind you that it exists. And just how sort of trauma and abuse was visited on Legion, who, in his own way, perpetuated it by creating these other identities, right? Mm-hmm. They're almost his children in a way. Mm-hmm. And how it takes the kids to really to snap him out of that. I think, you know, Moonstar, or Mirage, as she was known at the time, kind of a Claremont favorite. You can tell, like, that's like one of his pet characters, but she is really well served in this story, I thought.
Well, since the beginning of the run with Demon Bear, ever since Demon Bear, she's been like the lead, like kind of leader of this, and it just plays out over long term. So she definitely sticks out.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would probably give this, I think I'd go 8 out of 10 on it too, honestly.
And one thing I want to add that Tim said, and again, no one except for me here was reading this in 85 when it was actually coming out. the beauty of the mid-80s X-Men and New Mutants is there was only two series. So you could read the X-Men and read the New Mutants and be perfectly fine in the X-Men universe versus later years where you have, and even now where you have 50 different X-Men titles. So the other reason why I would suggest it is go back to a simpler time, read the X-Men and read the New Mutants corresponding, because they're really good, simple reads and they intermesh really well back then. That's the only other thing I would add.
Absolutely. And I would add to that by saying, it took me a second to pull it up. If you like this story or you want to spend some more time just sort of in and around this world and have some greater context, the backstory between Xavier and Gabrielle Haller, and I guess also Magneto, was actually explored in a flashback issue. It was, if I have this right, Uncanny X-Men 117. That was a Claremont Byrne issue, in fact. And that was from 1979.
Wow.
So pull that up on your Marvel Unlimited if you want to see where all this kind of got started. You'll see that's where Xavier did his work, so to speak, with Gabby.
He did some work.
Yeah.
Little skeek. Okay. So you gifted me this volume of New Mutants, Tim, for my birthday.
Mm.
And this little story was the first part of it. So
yeah, that kicks it off. I guess there's some other stuff in it though too, right?
Right. So it got me a little bit more than halfway through, and I was sad to have to put it down. So I'm definitely gonna continue reading for the rest of this volume at the very least. I really, really like this too. Everything that you guys said, spot on. Between the art and the like weird story, like this is some weird stuff, and I'm kind of here for it. So I think I might go 7 out of 10 on it, but I really did like it too.
So you're digging it. You're feeling this type of storytelling and wanting some more.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean, as we were comparing notes earlier today, that other comic where we see an early Charles Xavier make an ethical lapse in his treatment of a woman, I'm going to throw out another recommendation. Uncanny X-Men 309. This is from the 90s. How about that? And that was a flashback story where takes place after Charles met Gabby. And in fact, after he was injured and being nursed back to health by a nurse. How about that? A literal nurse. And they begin a relationship, as you do. Her name, Sean, do you remember her name? Because I have it in front of me.
Amelia Vault? Is that her
name? Yes. You got it.
Yep.
bought, just like the corporation on The Boys.
Totally Googled that.
I totally did. But, yeah. I Googled the name.
All good.
I remember. Thanks for calling me out on that. I sound like a genius therapist.
Totally Googled it.
That's awesome.
But it's a really good issue from the 90s. That sort of,
it's called
in a way.
When the Tigers Come at Night was the name of the.
Story. I know. Yeah, you clearly knew that off the top of your head.
No, I'm reading it in the same Google machine. Yeah.
What a title! But yeah, there's another big ethical lapse by Charles, although not professional in this case. That was by Amelia hooking up with her patient. Mm. So, but he does something there that he very quickly catches himself, second guesses that he did it, but the damage is done. And it's pretty good stuff for 90s X-Men comics. That's also not everyone's bag. So anyway, do check it out. I think it's a nice little companion to this story. In addition to that earlier X-Men, what did I say? 117?
Yep, 117.
Those ought to be on Marvel Unlimited if you want to run them down.
All right, thank you for listening to this little extra bonus track of Unwrapped.